This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yisru Heben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Burundi's parliament is set to begin reviewing a report from a national commission convened by the president that says the people are in favour of scrapping term limits. Is this a sign the ruling party has been able to use a year-long political crisis to consolidate power, or could this revitalise opposition?
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting on Burundi. Details coming up.
Also, more protests are expected in the country's major cities of Harare and Bulawayo this week, as 70 people are expected to appear in court in Zimbabwe today. We'll have these stories as the UN asks for $10 million in humanitarian assistance for northeastern Nigeria.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, in Gabon, opposition candidate John Ping has claimed an early victory in the weekend presidential election. However, UN Chief Ban Ki-moon is urging presidential candidates to wait for official results of the vote. Election officials are expected to announce the winner tomorrow. There were 11 candidates. President Ali Bongo is running for re-election to a seven-year term. Bongo, who's 57 years old, first won election in 2009. He took office after the death of his father, Omar Bongo, spent 42 years in power. Gabon's constitution has no term limits. Ping, who is 73, is the former head of the African Union Commission and previously served as foreign minister of Gabon.
In Zimbabwe, nearly 70 people were charged with public violence today, stemming from last Friday's protests in Harare. Reuters reports the court will decide tomorrow whether they should be released from custody while awaiting trial. They were not asked to enter a plea today in court. The protesters face a fine and up to 10 years in jail if convicted. The government is short of cash and has struggled to pay its more than 300,000 workers. Those salaries consume more than 80% of the national budget. The cash crisis has fueled recent demonstrations against President Mugabe, who has ruled Zimbabwe for 29 years. On Friday, police used tear gas and water cannon to break up demonstrations. More protests are expected in the country's major cities of Harare and Bulawayo this week. Opposition parties say they fear the president will declare a state of emergency in response to the protests. Reuters says about 100 riot police officers stood guard at the court today.
Burundi's parliament is reviewing a report from a national commission that says the population is in favor of scrapping term limits. The commission was convened by President Pierre Nkurunziza. Observers say it may be a sign that the ruling party has been able to use the year-long political crisis to consolidate power. But they also say it could revitalize the opposition. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In October 2015, the government of Burundi formed a commission to find a solution to the country's political crisis. The crisis began the previous April when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced a plan to run for a third term, a move that critics said violated the constitution and the Arusha Peace Agreement that ended the country's civil war. The 15-member committee was tasked with collecting the views of Burundians on the best way to put a stop to the crisis. Almost a year later, Parliament is set to debate the committee's provisional report, which says a majority of Burundians favour abolishing the two-term limit from the constitution. Vital Nshirimana is the head of Burundi's Forum for Strengthening Civil Society. He says the views presented to the Parliament do not represent those of all Burundians.
From the starting of the commission, we noticed that the commission was exclusive because happened to people that are members of the CNDP, FCD, or its allies, who from the beginning actually talked about the amendment of the Constitution and the cancellation of term limits because they believed that this was an obstacle for Nkurunziza to run the country forever.
The opposition group SINARED, whose members are mostly in exile, has accused the government of blocking it from taking part in the political dialogue. The government has said it is reluctant to speak to those who were involved in armed conflict in the country. Hundreds of people died in clashes between protesters and security agencies last year. The commission's president, Bishop Justin Zoyusaba, acknowledges the commission has consulted only a quarter of the organizations with whom they plan to speak.
We had some groups like journalists. We have not talked to journalists. We have not talked to businessmen. We have some groups that we had to speak to. We had a group of, I think, 20 groups, and we have already talked to six groups. But we have to speak to them before we give the final report.
Some opposition members say that if term limits are eliminated, it will be a setback for democracy. Vital says the move to change the constitution will create more problems.
This is extremely dangerous because this will lead to the same causes that led to the crisis, that led to the civil war.
More than 300,000 Burundians were killed in the 13-year war, which ended in 2006. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
About 3,000 people from nearly 130 countries have gathered in Stockholm for the annual World Water Week Summit. This year's theme is Water for Sustainable Growth. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The Stockholm International Water Institute is hosting the summit, calling 2016 a critical year for addressing the role of water in development. The meeting follows the adoption of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, and the historic Paris Climate Change Agreement. Anton Earl is director of the Institute's Africa Regional Center, based in Pretoria, South Africa.
All other efforts to promote development would really come to nothing if we aren't supplying the water that is needed. I mean, any development intervention you can think of, whether it's in healthcare, in education, in agriculture.
He explains why it's difficult to provide children with a good education without clean water.
You have schools being built across Africa where governments are really getting to grips with the education backlog. And then these schools not having a secure water supply. And because they don't have a secure water supply, they very frequently don't have adequate sanitation. The net result is that especially girls not going to school because of this.
Despite the strong link between clean water and development, making the issue a priority at international climate talks has been difficult.
Essentially, climate change is all caused by changes in the atmosphere of the planet. We know that, you know, changes in the makeup of carbon, methane, other greenhouse gases that are impacting the atmosphere. So that's well known. But the way that climate change will impact the world will, of course, be through water. The flow of water through the atmosphere, the increase in evaporation, the changes in hydrology, changes in runoff that will occur.
The Stockholm International Water Institute official says it's easier to create business models for the energy and telecommunication industries than it is for water.
Water is different. You know, water's got this connotation of being a human right. As soon as you start moving too strongly towards private sector engagement and the implication that a private company might make profit from supplying water, it becomes very politically contentious. There's no easy answer to this, and you always have to be looking at the issues around access and equity. So that could be part of the problem.
Working in Africa, Earl has found the continent has its own particular challenges in using water for development. He says it's not doing what it needs to do, and that is invest about $9 billion a year in water infrastructure. This includes dams, urban water systems, water treatment, and sanitation systems.
So this is a huge backlog, larger than any other region in the world. In many other parts of the world, the issue is more around how do you more effectively manage the infrastructure that exists today. In Africa, yes, that is part of the equation. However, you also have a really big backlog just in new infrastructure that does need to be built.
Also, he says computer models show large parts of Africa will be among the hardest hit by climate change. In other words, more frequent and more severe droughts and floods.
Affecting communities, but also affecting cities and the ability of cities to provide secure water services to their residents. And of course, as we know, Africa is one of the fastest urbanizing parts of the world today. Some of the most rapidly growing cities in the world are located on the African continent.
World Water Week organizers say the meeting aims to support SDG number 8, which is to promote sustained, inclusive and sustainable growth, full and productive employment, and decent work for all. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
16 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization is asking for $10 million for humanitarian assistance to northeastern Nigeria. The money would help support over 350,000 people displaced by the terrorist group Boko Haram. The internally displaced are in need of seeds, fertilizers, and equipment for irrigated farming as the dry season approaches. So far, three consecutive planting seasons have been lost due to the violence and fight. Michele Di Benedetto is the Emergency and Rehabilitation Officer for the FAO in Rome. He's also the UN agency's search coordinator for the Lake Chad crisis. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle about the FAO's plans for northeastern Nigeria over the next few months.
FAO plans in the next 6 months to support vulnerable households, to have access to some agricultural inputs, to enable them to cultivate during the lean season. The lean season should be supported with allowing them to cultivate in irrigated plots. Some of these are shared among communities. They are somehow the main livelihood activity that can be supported at this moment in northeast Nigeria. In terms of pastoralists, what FAO is trying to do is to address what has been a complete disruption of the livestock systems in terms of trade and movement, which means that a lot of the cattle has been weakened. The condition of the animals is not good. Pastoralists have a hard time accessing grazing areas. So what FAO would like to do, we would like to support the pastoralists with deworming, antiparasites, and feed integrators in order to try to support the health and the status of the livestock. This is immediate. Of course, there are interventions for pastoralists which might look at beyond, let's say, 6 months and go to the next season, which is rehabilitation of the trail routes, maybe some restocking or destocking activities according to what the condition of the herd is.
The FAO press release has mentioned that the harvest in northeastern Nigeria is expected at the end of September. How do things look at this point with regard to that harvest?
What we would like to have for that harvest is that part of the harvest in general, both for the vegetable and the crop, would allow on one side to make the households more food secure and provide the vulnerable households with some ability to have access to local markets to sell their products. So what we're trying to do is also support those same households during the next dry season, the lean season, which is starting exactly around October, November, to provide them with vegetable inputs. So that would also allow them on one side to have, let's say, a nutrition integration and additional sources of livelihood by selling those vegetables to the local market. And by doing that, we try on one side to support whomever IDP is willing and has the possibility to return to his village of origin, and to address the ones who don't have the conditions in their village of origin to return, to be able to at least have some nutritious food production for their household, wherever they are in urban or peri-urban areas, and have at least some livelihood mechanism by selling the products in the market.
Currently, we're in the wet season, and it will be followed by, of course, the dry season. What is the difference in the needs of the people in the Northeast now during the wet season versus their needs in the dry season, which would begin in October?
It's totally different crops. What we have been distributing for this main season is basically, yes, millet, sorghum, cowpeas. While for the dry season, what we aim at distributing are some varieties of local vegetables and some quite common vegetables. We're distributing okra, rosella, tomatoes, cabbage, carrot, lettuce, onion, and we try to diversify the kids according to the different areas and to the preferences of the different communities.
That was FAO official Michele Di Benedetto. He spoke from Abuja with VOA's William Eagle.
The new generation of militants blowing up Nigeria's petroleum and natural gas pipelines say they are fighting the rampant oil pollution and poverty that plagues parts of southern Nigeria. The Niger Delta Avengers have the sympathy of some local politicians and the growing attention of President Muhammadu Buhari in Abuja. One petroleum industry observer is suggesting that former Nigeria President Goodluck Jonathan might be able to negotiate a deal between the government and the Avengers. Matthew Bay is an analyst for Stratfor Intelligence based in the U.S. state of Texas. He talked to VOA's David Arnold about the Niger Delta militants, the sporadic ceasefire, and a possible role for Mr. Jonathan, the Delta's native son.
When we look at militancy in the Niger Delta, we have to realize that there is a political component. So a lot of the Niger Delta Avengers' actual stakeholders, while there are the youth guys who want to get some sort of a payment, a lot of the thing that allows them to proliferate and allows them some sort of a cover against the government's ability to stop them are actually local political actors as opposed to just militancy themselves. And a lot of the political demands are right around revenue sharing. And the other big one is, of course, going to be things like environmental issues. Now, that's actually come up more recently as President Muhammadu Buhari has actually started some cleanup activities, particularly in the western half of the Delta region. However, he has not necessarily made the political commitment to actually show up and start these operations. He has said he was going to make a big visible display of his support for these cleanup operations, even though the company started them, and he actually did no-showed at some of these events. And that's kind of been a black eye on his record with the communities. So we're starting to see it really morph into what is kind of a divide between northern Nigeria under Buhari and the southern Nigeria, particularly Niger Delta, the region, which is why the political action of the militancy is becoming more and more frequent.
Does that make it more difficult for the president to come in to negotiate? And what could he possibly offer them?
Absolutely makes it more difficult. So he's going to have to rely on informal kind of negotiations. He's going to have to go through conduits within the Society of the Niger Delta region. One of those potential conduits could be the former president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan. Another one can be a more elder figure like Chief Edwin Bart. That restricts the ability to negotiate directly, but it also increases his ability to actually deal with some of the broader issues in negotiating. That could be a problem when it comes to enforcement. For example, if you do negotiate a deal with Goodluck Jonathan, the question becomes then, well, how much actual control over the militants does Goodluck Jonathan have? Can he actually stop the kids that are in the creeks from actually blowing up pipelines? And the answer there is unclear, and that's going to be one limitation that he has. He has to worry about the distribution of wealth towards other regions of the country. One of the things that he can do is make sure that some of the programs in place, like the amnesty program, is actually well-funded, or he can try to negotiate with the political actors so that there is a little bit more of a fair distribution of oil wealth to local communities. But the big thing I want to stress is that it's a big country, and the Niger Delta is just one. And from Buhari's point of view, he has to deal with a bunch of different issues at once, and he has limited resources to do so.
Who are the leaders of the Niger Delta Avengers?
Relatively unclear exactly who the leaders of the group are. Most people seem to believe that they are not the same militants that were running around about 5 years ago, but rather a newer, younger generation who wants to emulate them. Now, the political actors don't necessarily give support, but kind of give tacit approval towards it or morph it into a political statement. Those are just typically going to be your communal leaders in various communities that these guys are operating from and or the state level.
I understand that the Niger Delta Avengers declared a ceasefire, but the joint task forces killed two and arrested three. Does that create a problem?
Yes, it does. So while the Niger Delta Avengers did say that they were willing to have a ceasefire and talk with the government, they put out some pretty significant conditions on having those talks. They wanted to make sure that representatives from the same countries that the oil companies are from are actually mediating them. They wanted to make sure it was done through these localized channels that they were creating. So they are trying to negotiate, but on a very high demand, very strong limitations on exactly what that is. And I think that we should look at the ceasefire as being something that's going to ebb and flow, where we see the militancy take action against the armies. Going forward, you're going to see these flare-ups, especially as negotiations stop. There's not a lot of trust that's going on between them. So the Niger Delta Avengers, they don't really trust the government. They're going to make sure that the government knows they still have the ability to conduct attacks on infrastructure.
What's the impact among the foreign oil companies?
Nigeria's oil production is down approximately 700,000 barrels per day. About half of that is directly due to militancy affecting pipelines by the Niger Delta militants. Other parts of it have been through actual smuggling and or sabotage of the pipelines, which is a little bit different type of violence that's against it. It's more criminal in nature as opposed to political nature violence that we've seen out of some of the more militant groups that have actually sprouted up over the last year. So the companies themselves, we've seen some of the attacks on their physical infrastructure at ports and pipelines. But we have not seen a significant activity directed against the companies themselves, like their personnel.
Does that mean that the companies are willing to continue to do business as is?
More and more of them are continuing to look more offshore for opportunities as opposed to onshore. But the companies that are onshore right now, like Shell, Exxon, Eni, are still continuing those onshore relationships as long as they can still produce. For a lot of these companies, particularly in the eastern part of the Niger Delta, or the western part of the Niger Delta, haven't been able to do some of the repairs on the pipeline necessary, so they aren't doing a lot of activity on the ground. Nigeria is becoming less and less of an investment opportunity.
That was Matthew Bay, a petroleum and analyst with Stratford Intelligence, based in the city of Austin in the U.S. state of Texas. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold.
The chief monitor of South Sudan's peace process, former Botswana President Festus Mahai, says he and other diplomats support the recent appointment of Taban Deng as the country's new first vice president. Mr. Mahai is chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. He told the Associated Press that neither President Salva Kiir nor former first vice president Riek Machar wanted the peace agreement that ended 3 years of fighting. Deng was appointed last month by Mr. Kiir after Machar had disappeared from public view. Machar recently slipped across the border into eastern DRC and from there traveled to the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, where he received medical treatment.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
In our next edition of Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth discussion on democracy and the rule of law in Uganda, join us right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
When news is happening,
VOA Africa is there.
Mohammed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.